ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, I'm Patricia Carvelis, the host of the Politics Now podcast. And navigating what our rapidly changing world means can be tricky.
There's an argument that there's still a lot of uncertainty, isn't there, around the drivers of the global energy market?
That's why I'm joined by the sharpest political minds at the ABC to break down what each development means for Australia and how the government is positioning.
The Prime Minister's keeping his options open. He can increase that reduction or he can take it away altogether and go back to the system that where it was before the war started.
That's Politics Now with me, Patricia Carvelis. Find it on ABC Listen.
Vladimir Putin is under pressure. His war is running off course, with the capital, Moscow, now under sustained attack for the first time since the conflict began. Ukrainian drone strikes are leading to major fuel shortages and growing discontent among the Russian people. Today, Simon Schuster, a staff writer at The Atlantic magazine, on the growing pressure on Putin to end the war. I'm Sam Hawley on Gadigal Land in Sydney. This is ABC News Daily. Simon, why don't we start with what the residents of Moscow are experiencing right now? Because really, for the first time since the Ukraine war began, they're facing sustained attacks, aren't they?
Yeah, the technological advances on the Ukrainian side in terms of their drone and missile program has really allowed the Ukrainians to bring the war home to the Russian public in a way that we've never seen. So the Ukrainians have had a very sustained campaign over several months now, targeting Russian energy infrastructure, oil refineries, and logistics. And that's led to very serious fuel shortages around the country.
Yeah, and there are these images out of Moscow with the skies filled with black smoke of these really long queues at petrol stations.
I guess I'm going to have to leave my car right here. I've been standing for an hour and a half now. The situation is not good, and this is very annoying.
There's a kilometre-long queue. They're holding back and trying to show that there is gasoline, but it's not there.
I mean, the war really is on the doorstep of the Russian capital now, like it never has been before.
Yeah, I mean, I think at this point we have to remember that the casualty numbers on the Russian side are so high, more than a million dead and wounded over the course of the last 4 years, that most Russian families, it's safe to say, have someone close to them who has been directly affected by the war. So it's not like the Russian public has been insulated completely. But I think these fuel shortages are just a daily reminder, nuisance, that this thing is creeping closer. The war is creeping closer and deeper into their daily lives. And of course, that leads to much more frustration with the war, with the Russian leadership, with how long the war has gone on, how costly it's become for Russia. And we see that showing up also in opinion polls about the war and about Vladimir Putin.
So clearly, Vladimir Putin is under increasing pressure. And you note, Simon, that when things get dicey in Moscow, Vladimir Putin tends to disappear for a while. What do you mean?
Yeah, I mean, this has been a trend. You know, I've been reporting on Putin for better part of 20 years now. And this has been pretty consistent with him. When there's a national crisis, when there's some kind of leadership struggle inside the Kremlin, he often just sort of ducks out and waits for things to calm down before reemerging and making a statement. We've seen this with the Ukrainian drone attacks in the last few months. He's avoided the subject pretty consistently. He's not talked about it, even as it has flooded Russian social media and, you know, everyone has felt the fuel shortages in Russia. Putin has avoided talking about it until about a week ago. He finally gave a pretty detailed statement in a very scripted state television interview, where he was very dismissive, actually, of the frustrations of the Russian people, and spent most of that interview talking about these plodding, slow gains that Russia continues to make at enormous cost in human lives in eastern Ukraine. So he spent, you know, more than 10 minutes detailing, sometimes street by street, the fighting that Russia was waging in eastern Ukraine, and basically ignored or brushed away the fuel shortages and the Ukrainian drone strikes that have really caused so much pain and frustration among Russians.
Its aim is at least to create a sense of uncertainty in us, in our own capabilities, and ideally of causing a split within Russian society and forcing Russia to suspend, even if only briefly, the advance of our troops along the line of contact, creating conditions for the start of a negotiation process on terms favourable to the adversary. We will not give them that chance.
Yeah, so he's really doubling down on this war, which he calls, of course, a special military operation. That's all you can call it if you're in Russia. And also, of course, he then retaliated, didn't he, with Russia hitting the Ukrainian capital in a major way. It was described as the most massive attack Kyiv has seen since the start of the war.
It was, yeah. Just a few days later, everybody was expecting it. I think President Zelensky was at the time in visiting Ireland. He rushed back to Kyiv as the warnings came in that Russia was preparing this strike. The intelligence services are generally pretty good at predicting when Russia's going to launch one of these. And this one, I think, stood out in my mind, first of all, for its scale. It was larger than any other in terms of the number of drones and missiles launched. But also the targeting was just so blatantly desperate for the Russian side. They were hitting apartment blocks, a playground got hit. You know, really clearly civilian targets.
It's Russia's worst attack on the country since mid-June, with waves of drones and missiles hitting residential buildings and a hotel on Kyiv's Central Boulevard, shaking the city for hours.
Authorities in Kyiv have described the latest Russian strike as the most massive attack ever on the Ukrainian capital. Russian forces used missiles and drones to cause mass destruction and casualties.
It wasn't clear if it was meant in any way to achieve some kind of strategic goal other than lashing out, really taking some kind of revenge for what the Ukrainians have been doing in their strikes on Moscow and energy infrastructure across Russia. It looked like, a real attack in anger and revenge rather than achieving anything strategically from Russia's point of view.
Well, Simon, let's turn now to what it all means for Vladimir Putin and his future. Now, it's clear, isn't it, that he has really no intention of ending this war. What's going on in his mind, do you think?
I mean, I think he's really just put all of his chips on the table at this point, and he sees this as the defining struggle of his very long reign. He's been in power now for more than a quarter century. He thinks of this war and treats it and talks about it like some kind of calling from on high, like the mission that he's destined to complete, and almost in a maniacal way. It's fair to say, looking at his statements, looking at the way he talks about the minutia of the fighting, that he really lives this stuff, you know, and he's not looking beyond the war to some kind of peace negotiations. In his last statement, he was very dismissive of all attempts to negotiate a peace, and I didn't have any sense that he is preparing or prepared to sit down and negotiate in good faith.
Yeah, but you note that the gap between what Russians know to be true about the war and what the Kremlin says is actually growing. And as you mentioned, there is polling now showing that the tide is turning against Vladimir Putin and against this war. What are we seeing from these polls? What do they show us?
Well, in the beginning of the full-scale invasion, there was pretty strong support, really surprisingly strong support among the Russian public for Putin, what he was doing. Russians generally said, large majorities of them said that the country is going in the right direction in various polling. And only in the last few months, as these Ukrainian drone strikes have really intensified, we've seen that switch where a majority in some polls, as much as 80%, say that they want the war to end as soon as possible. So in one poll that came out a few days ago, actually the same day that Putin gave his statement on state TV, there was a poll that found only 9% of respondents in Russia say they want the war to continue for as long as it takes to achieve victory. 9% is very small. So that gap, not only between the reality that Russians know and see and what they see on television. That is a massive gap, as you noted, but also the gap between Putin's war aims and the desires of the public is also growing. And that's harder for Putin to manage. I mean, he is an authoritarian leader. He's a dictator. There's no democracy in Russia that would allow the Russian public to control or influence what Putin does. But he's still sensitive to public opinion, and he's always been afraid of some kind of popular unrest, protests. You know, they haven't come these last 4 years of war, but it could be that this is the point that causes some backlash, some popular resistance to this war, the point when Russians start to feel it at the gas pump.
Yes, because complaints have also been flooding social media, haven't they? Which really that has been heightened by this lack of fuel.
Yeah, in these videos, it's almost a whole genre of videos on Russian social networks of them waiting in line for fuel, unable to find gas at the gas station, driving around and saying, what is going on? Where's the gasoline? How could Russia, one of the biggest producers of oil and gas in the world, not have gasoline at the pump? So, you know, these videos and remarks and comments have flooded social networks, and they really show how clearly the state TV and state propaganda apparatus has lost control or lost the ability to control the narrative, which is increasingly being shaped by social networks and the conversations there.
Yeah, interesting. And do we know at all how it's going down among the Russian elites and what it might mean, in fact, for Putin's leadership? Is he under real pressure, do you think?
I didn't have that sense, you know. Yeah. I mean, he's very deliberately and consistently purged any potential opponents. There isn't a kind of opposition force or even an informal clan within the Kremlin that we know of that could pose any opposition to him. So I don't see where a kind of palace coup could realistically come from. Mm. It could materialize if things get really dramatic, especially with the economy, some kind of massive economic collapse or shock. But honestly, I didn't have the sense from Putin's last remarks that he's trying to be accommodating or looking for compromise with any forces, external or internal, to Russia.
All right, well, Simon, over the weekend, the US President Donald Trump had a telephone conversation with Vladimir Putin and with the Ukrainian leader Volodymyr Zelensky about the possibility of a peace deal, which he wants to be involved in. But really, there's only one of those leaders that is interested in it, isn't there? And it's not Vladimir Putin. Is there any point talking to Vladimir Putin at this point about a peace deal, do you think?
I think Putin isn't yet there. I mean, as President Zelensky has pointed out time and again, that the only way to get to a peace deal or get a negotiating process started is to force Putin to the table through sanctions and other means of pressure, including military pressure. Actually, President Zelensky has cheekily taken to calling these drone strikes long-range sanctions. So he sees all of that, including the diplomacy that he's undertaking in Europe and around the world, as all geared toward one goal, to force Putin to the negotiating table. And, you know, what we see from Putin's statements and his behavior and the behavior of the Russian military, Putin is not there. And he thinks that if he keeps pushing, he can get to victory eventually.
So Putin has given no indication that he wants to end the war. What's he going to do now, do you think?
It looks like he's going to continue pressing his advantage on the battlefield, trying to push forward again, street by street, kilometer by kilometer. That takes an enormous number of soldiers. They've continued to recruit by offering recruits, soldiers, huge signing bonuses to join the military, really life-changing sums of money, the equivalent of, say, $80,000 just to sign up. And for a young man in the Russian provinces, that really is a rather convincing sum. Mm-hmm. So they have been able to recruit tens of thousands per month, but the Ukrainian forces on their side, especially using drones again, they are chalking up casualties on the Russian side, killing or wounding Russians on average 30,000 per month. So taking them off the battlefield. That is a very difficult rate of attrition for Russia to sustain, but it's not clear how long Putin will be able to continue recruiting. One option that he can reach for is a mobilization, sort of a draft, to call a mandatory draft. He did that once early in the war in September 2022. It was very disruptive for the Russian economy and caused a lot of anger among the Russian public. But his regime survived, and he could do that again. He could call up, you know, another few hundred thousand Russian soldiers and continue fighting for some time.
Even if he does that, though, there's no guarantee he can win this war, is there, at this point?
No. I mean, at the rate they're advancing now, without some major breakthrough on the front, they would need years to achieve the stated territorial goals that Putin has made public. So I can't imagine that either side could sustain the war for that long. Something's going to have to give. But at this point, yeah, Putin seems intent on continuing to pour the lives of his soldiers into this war and the economy, and the Russian state, the Russian people are going to be paying the price for generations to come.
Simon Schuster is a staff writer at The Atlantic magazine. This episode was produced by Sydney Peed. Audio production by Sam Dunn. Our supervising producer is David Cody. I'm Sam Hawley. Thanks for listening.